Welcome to this week's edition of Politics in Full Sentences, an intelligent take on the week's politics with a strong lashing of free markets and free minds.
Welcome to Politics in Full Sentences. We're back again, folks, and we've got another exciting episode for you. So tonight, of course, we've got two wonderful guests, who people you probably will recognise. David Seymour is the leader of ACT and our key man and the man of the moment, actually. Welcome, David.
Good evening. Good to see you, Max.
Yeah. And Beth Holbrook, and it's wonderful to see you, Beth.
Thank you.
And looking so healthy, well, and jolly.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, folks, tonight's subject is the abortion law reform and freedom of speech. Now, there's some actions that have been occurring in Parliament that David's going to fill us in on. And also, I'd be interested to know more about the law reform and why we need it and what benefits it's going to give our society, if any. So that'll be a good discussion. I'm sure that Beth's got a point of view in that regard as well. But our nation's been hit, or our globe has been hit with a mass virus, and I think we should touch on that today before we launch into our major subject. There's been some big announcements coming out from our Prime Minister, David, and I haven't had a chance to catch up with any comments you have made, but certainly she's restricting any public gatherings of over 500 people. She's obviously the other announcements we're all aware of in terms of people having to isolate themselves. And she's also asking what she can do to our tourists that ignore her orders and actually don't isolate themselves. Just wondering where you're seeing things at the moment, David.
Well, you go back to the beginning. Humanity is being ravaged by a virus that has three really important characteristics. One is that it is quite lethal. So if you look at like what percentage of people who contract a virus actually die, the Spanish flu, which was a major disaster, killed more people than World War I, happening immediately after that war. That was about 2% fatality. There's different estimates for the fatality rate for COVID-19. So some people are saying it could be as low as the 0.1s or 2s. Some people are saying it could be as high as 4%, double the Spanish flu. The next thing is the transmissibility. So how easily does it spread? And it looks like it spreads pretty well. Like it could, you know, quite conceivably get to half the population in a few months. So, you know, in a couple of months, you're looking at hundreds of thousands, millions of cases just in New Zealand. And, you know, anywhere from a fraction of a percent to maybe 3 or 4% of those people dying. In those scenarios, you're looking at nearly 100,000 people dying in New Zealand at the top end. But it has a third characteristic, which is really important. So it's not just potentially lethal, we don't know. It's not just quite easily spread. It's also got a really long incubation period. So it takes 14 days, we think, from when you contract it, and then a virus sort of burrows into your cells and makes itself at home and reproduces itself and then bursts out like a little parasite. It takes 14 days. So there's a period of time, not quite that long, but maybe a week, where you have it but you don't know. And one of the things that means that we really struggle to understand how many people have it, and that affects the first two characteristics, or at least how we measure them. So it may be the death rate's much lower than we think, because it's spreading way faster than we think, and we just don't have enough testing. So you take those three characteristics and you say, wow, it's big, there's not a lot of information, it's potentially going to have a huge impact, and that's what the government's dealing with, a really challenging situation. And so as an opposition, we don't have as much information as the government. It's not really helpful at this point to criticise them, and I'll get to why that is in a second. But we do have to play a role holding them accountable and offering constructive criticism and solutions where necessary, and conveying the community's ideas to the government. And a lot of people have been reaching out. Now, the reason why I think it's important we don't criticise them too much is that if you're sitting in the government's position, you look at your incentives and you say, if we overreact, there'll be huge economic damage, but we'll be able to say we save lives. If we underreact, the economy might not be so bad. However, the economy is going to be bad anyway because of the rest of the world. and people may blame us for underreacting and people dying as a result. So the government's incentive is already to overreact, and we don't want them to overreact. We want them to get it right. So I think that's an important reason for politicians and opposition and, you know, ACT and National, not to overegg the criticism, but to be supportive and offer constructive criticism. Just a couple of other thoughts. We will get through this. You know, New Zealand is a very resourceful, and I think that by looking out for each other, you know, by taking the old Sir Ernest Rutherford, we didn't have much money, so we had to think, being resourceful and using our wits, then we're going to come through this just like New Zealand has come through many other tragedies, and frankly, some of them, like wars and depressions and so on, quite a lot worse. But it's critical that the government response on the economy has got right. So Adrian Orr slashing, you know, a 75% cut in the official cash rate from 1% right down to 0.25.
Yeah.
Huge.
That was huge, right?
Bigger than they did in the great financial crisis. It's gone from 1.25 to 0.25. They've cut, 1.5, so 1.25%.
What does that mean, David? Does that mean we can borrow money easier?
Well, you know, you'd hope that banks are going to pass that through to people in their mortgage rates. So if it means that, you know, let's say they pass through 0.5% and that comes off people's mortgages, then somebody who's maybe got a $500,000 mortgage, suddenly that's $25,000 a year. You know, that's, that's another $50 a week. So $2,500 a year that they've got. That's more spending cash in the economy. So that's really positive. Although I do wonder where Adrian Orr's going to go next, because he can't cut any further. So they're going to have to start actually printing money in order to keep things going. The government's going to do some sort of stimulus package. But I just say to them, the rule for the government should be first do no harm. So the government needs, first of all, before it starts giving out money, stop taking so much. So the opportunities are to reduce taxes, mm-hmm. Reduce provisional tax, give people a tax holiday. Those are the sorts of things that the government could be doing that would make things a lot better for a lot of people. The second thing is, the government could choose to stop introducing damaging regulations. So raising the minimum wage on employers that are already struggling with cash flow.
That would be ridiculous.
Insane. Yeah. They've yeah. got to back down. I know they've backed themselves into a corner, but please, the government's got to back down on that. But there's also a whole lot of other stuff, you know, regulations for landlords. We've talked about employment law on this thing before. You know, any kind of rules and regulations that are being pushed on people that will drive up costs and make it harder for people to employ, you know, that they need to follow Adrian Orr's advice. Adrian Orr was going to increase capital ratios on banks. He just said, nah, too vulnerable at the moment. That's off the agenda for another year. The government needs to do that with all its regulatory initiatives. Just say for the next year, we are not going to put any new costs on businesses.
That's interesting about the legislation, because I believe that you please clarify for me, because I know that the government said they're about to introduce some legislation. The minimum wage is one they've already got a date on it, which is a concern. Mm. But that's probably the only one. The other legislation's pending, and we don't have dates for it. So they actually could very comfortably postpone those for an indefinite period while waiting for this virus to be managed, perhaps. Would I be right with that sort of summary?
Yeah, I just look at something like, I mean, this is a minor thing, but their vaping legislation was the last law they introduced last week. You know, we're now potentially going to pass a law on a rush timeframe with they may ban public submissions to select committee. Mm. I just don't think we need to make laws like that. The truth is, this government has messed around for 2 years on vaping. I think they should have gone faster on banning it for kids. That's not the biggest problem we have right now. They should just cancel that rather than rush through laws while people aren't watching. I'll give you another example. The Ministry of Education is making, you know, changes we really should talk about, actually, when it comes to the NCEA, you know, just taking out a whole lot of rich content that the next generation deserves to to learn about in the name of I don't know what. It would be a real shame if we come out of this and the Ministry of Education's quietly been strip mining the education curriculum for NCEA and people say, whoa, I didn't know about that, because everyone was so focused on this crisis. So I think the government needs to basically stop lawmaking that is not related to getting through this crisis.
Well, certainly the focus is. Mm. Beth, what's your thoughts on the virus?
Well, what a difference a few days makes, I think. You know, it was this time last week I was welcoming 226 new citizens to a citizenship ceremony and shaking their hands still at that point. And just the thought that, you know, if there had been one person infected...
Oh, my goodness, you'd share it with everybody.
I would be sharing it with everyone, every one of those. So I would certainly like to see events like that, you know, mm-hmm.
Is that why you're sitting so far away over there?
Well, yeah, I'm practicing my social distance. I'm doing my one...
Don't touch her.
I am doing my 1 meter. I thought David wasn't going to come up for any air then and give me a chance to talk about this, but just in terms of...
He's had a lot to get out of the church, you know.
But... I'm an optimist. I'm just a natural optimist, and I look at the opportunities that may come out of this. And I think David touched on it. You know, we're resilient, we're innovative. We, you know, the number eight wired technology culture, and we're going to see quite a shift, I think, in the way people respond. In business and just, you know, with the way that there'll be a lot of people self-isolating, mm-hmm. there'll be a lot of people probably quarantined as well. So there's going to be a lot, I think there'll be a lot of services offered and pop up that will cater to those people. So more home deliveries of essential items, you know, not just groceries, but, you know, some of these businesses that make meals, I think they're going to
of benefits and positives. The good thing that's going to come out of this, and this is from my world of employment world, is that people are going to have to work from home.
Yes.
And the employer is going to get to see that and yes. going to get more comfortable with it, and people will become naturally
more. Well, here's
more
what I've been thinking about that working from home, more people working from home, more services that pop up, more solutions. And, you know, you think about the Christchurch earthquakes and the Volunteer Student Army, there are going to be a lot of people offering to do things and they want to move quite quickly and not go through a heavy bureaucratic process to be given the permission to do so. So I would be looking out for hooks and legislation that is actually preventing people from, you know, getting on with it and coming up with solutions. So, you know, I'd hate to think that there's some stupid regulations out there that are going to prevent people being able to help each other in that way. The other thing, and it is in that sort of relief side, is we've talked about, you know, some of the things that ACT would like to see done. In the accommodation provider business, there's a lot of people doing Airbnb or having, you know, who have holiday rentals, and they're suffering at the moment from a lot of cancellations.
Yes.
Now, in Auckland particularly, they pay an accommodation provider targeted rate, and that's based on an assumption that they're going to let their property out for a certain number of days per year based on the previous year.
There should be some relief on that,
Beth. And that's struck once a year and it's for the whole year and you can't change it.
No.
Now I would like to see some relief coming for those people who've got cancelled bookings, and also that they're charged business rates on some of those properties as well. Perhaps the councils could look at not rating them as a business, because they could be providing great accommodation for self-isolation.
I just would like to just one more positive before we move on to our main subject, because we're almost halfway through. But certainly to say that the good news, I want to give you guys feedback. I deal with employment disputes every day. I haven't had one about this matter. What I'm sensing, there's a cooperation between employers and employees. Let's get through this together and let's take the battle on head on. And they're both aware what the future could hold. And I think that's very positive for a nation who can be split, angry with each other. This is actually coming together. And a good thing is for our globe. We're at war. We're at war with a virus, and it's the globe. Every country in this globe right now have got the same problem. And we're saying, let's try and face it together.
Yeah, it's like one of those movies where humanity unites against the aliens, except it's a virus.
This would make a good movie, but this is real.
I'm sure there will be many movies about this, but we've got to get through it first.
It's the history. Righto, moving on. So the abortion law. I really don't touch on this in my world, in my life at all very much, and I guess a lot of New Zealand citizens won't out there either. So the question, the first question is, and of course we're going to talk about freedom of speech, and you would wonder where the association is between the two, because of, I would say, of abortions, people try to keep that very confidential and private. But in terms of that, the first question I would actually like to put to us, David, what was wrong with the old law?
So, okay, let's start from the beginning. A lot of people, I think, go down totally wrong routes, dead ends on this topic. So a lot of people want to have arguments about when life begins. A lot of people want to have arguments about a woman's right to autonomy over her own body. Now, I'm in favor of autonomy. I think arguing about life begins is basically pointless because everyone has a different view of that, it seems. What we should be talking about when it comes to policy is none of that. It's what's the role of government and does it make any difference? So I look at Canada, which has no statutory abortion laws whatsoever.
None.
And a lower rate of abortion than New Zealand. That should be the starting point. And once you've started with that, people who want to have laws around abortion need to come and tell us why they think that's a good idea. Do they think it will reduce the amount of abortion? Well, there's no evidence anywhere in the world that having more complicated laws reduces the amount of abortion. Then they have to start justifying some of the unintended consequences of laws on abortion. So one of them is just stigma, you know, making women often in impossible situations. Sometimes women who have been sexually assaulted, women who have to abort a fetus because the fetus or their own life is in danger, and that's the only way they can stay alive and be with their loved ones. Nice. People facing really difficult choices end up being stigmatized. So that's the first problem with having a law against it. Second problem is it's inequitable. So if you look at women who are in, you know, rural New Zealand, remote areas, have way tougher time getting through the rigmarole of our current laws than women who live in Auckland, Wellington, or Christchurch. And I think that's, you know, fundamentally unfair.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem with our current law is that it's a subterfuge. You know, our current law says that abortion is a crime unless the woman has a risk to her health, including her mental health. So women in New Zealand currently have to invent a fiction that they're somehow mentally unstable in order to access abortion. You think about that for a moment. Most New Zealanders like to tell the truth, be accepted for who they are, and not have to lie to authorities. But that's basically what the law's concocted. So this abortion law reform that takes abortion out of the Crimes Act means, number one, equitable access. Regardless of what you think about it, let's be equal. Number two, no stigma, because if you're not going to if you're against abortion, fine, but you're not going to reduce it. So why stigmatize people? And number three, let's get rid of the sophistry and just say, look, it's a choice for a woman to make about her own body. And then you get people saying, ah, what about, you know, you're a libertarian, you have to protect life. And I just come back again to what's the role of government. So if you think it's the role of government to go around forcing women to take pregnancies to term using their own bodies against their will, then you can't be much of a freedom lover.
I can imagine a lot of people debate that point with you, but I mean, it's
here's the thing, though.
The choices are made probably earlier than
here's the thing. People are saying that they want the government to go around, even though they know it's going to lead to stigma, inequity, and sophistry. They want the state to run around using women as vessels, forcing them to carry pregnancies to term against their will. I don't know how that's defensible. Now, you can still think abortion's horrible, be completely against it and all the rest. I get all that. I don't think it's a good idea either. Most of the people that have abortions aren't particularly happy about it. But this is not about that. This is about what should the role of government be. And the role of the government, as with so many things, should be to GTFO the way.
Oh, I got it. Okay. So David, Beth, what's your views on this?
Well, I probably come from a slightly more conservative viewpoint. I really don't like abortion. I don't like abortion. I would not like to see the rates of abortion increase. But that doesn't mean that I don't believe that the law needs changing. I agree we need to take it out of the Crimes Act and into put it in with health. One of the reasons that what would be the point of pursuing a criminal case against someone who's had an abortion? I've never been in that situation. I can't imagine what it's like to be in that person's shoes, to have to make that decision. I would find that extremely difficult myself. But having said that, I have supported people through abortion, even though I don't like abortion. So looking at the bill and hearing David's very convincing argument there, I must say, I agree with just most of what he's talking about, the fact that the stigma around mental health. If you have to go to a doctor and say that you have a mental illness and that it then is on your medical records, that could have consequences down the track. It could have consequences around pre-existing condition, and you could possibly be turned down for insurance, or you're a future employer may ask to see your medical records. So why would you want to have that on your record if it wasn't accurate? So yeah, I come back to, I don't like abortion. I hope that this law does, as David hopes, that it won't increase the rate of abortion if it's been shown in Canada. But something else I'd like to look at, and I know it's not in the scope of the legislation, I understand that, but I'm not in Parliament, so I can go off paper. I'm interested to know what the situation is with our adoption laws. I understand these people have difficulty adopting, and I feel that if we're a party of choice, who believes in choice, let's make sure that all those choices are available to women, and I'd be interested to look at adoption laws.
I probably haven't watched this. There's limited media coverage of this, and probably limited because I tried to do some research before we came on, and there's 3 or 4 articles out there about the law changes. And I see in 77, it's a year I left New Zealand to go overseas.
Couldn't handle the abortion law reform.
Exactly, because it was a heated debate in our society, and there was passion and all sorts of things. But we're different people now. We have different views. But I noticed in the print I've looked at this, there were 25,000 submissions. What were they saying? What are the New Zealanders actually saying? Or was there a congregation of people that perhaps thought that they're all anti it and organised all their friends to go anti it? I just don't understand why there was so much.
Hey, can we just come back to some of the questions? So Daniel Crisp says, question for you, David, re-abortion law reform, when does a life begin? All semantics about empowering women is silly if you're killing a life. Well, here's the thing for Daniel, and I think we covered this. You can choose whatever answer to that question you like. I don't really care. Because the answer is still the same. Is it going to be helpful to have a state prohibition? Will that reduce abortion? Because if Daniel's objective, it sounds like, is to save lives, which I think is where he's coming, what he's driving at, there's no evidence that a state prohibition is going to achieve that. It's just going to lead to inequity, subterfuge, sophistry, and discrimination and heartache. So, Daniel's, I just think, he's asking the wrong question. The right question is the one that Beth's asking, is how do you make it easier to adopt? Because people think these kids are unloved, and that they're not unloved. The adoption laws, in my view, are too difficult. Paul Milnick says, to force doctors and nurses to watch and let a child die without being allowed to save the child's life is despicable. I totally agree, but I have no idea why he thinks that's got anything to do. Certainly, there's nothing in the current legislation that says anything like that. So,
I believe doctors have a choice, don't they?
Well,
they can voice their...
Well, doctors can opt out of being involved in abortion whatsoever. But I think what he's trying to get at is that somehow this law makes doctors and nurses watch a child die. I really don't know what he's getting at there. In very late term abortions, inducement could produce a live fetus, in which case the job of doctors, the medical ethics remain to save the life of the child, just like any other time. If it produces a baby that's, or a fetus that's not alive, then they can't save the life. So I don't know what Daniel's on about there, to be quite frank. And what's the What was the question you asked before we got onto
that? Oh, it was the 25,000 submissions.
Yeah, so just on submissions, something's happened in the last few years called, and it's the internet. So it's become possible, if you get a well-organized campaign, you can bombard a select committee with submissions. And people have done this. I mean, on the End of Life Choice Act that I was responsible for, we got 40,000, 25,000. That's nothing. But the truth is that, you know, while it's a very easy thing to do for a campaign to, you know, rile people up and get them to send in submissions, often which are only one line, I don't think that's an indication. Mm-hmm. I think what is an indication is some of the more detailed submissions, which I was on this committee and we certainly paid a lot of attention to those. And it's also proper scientific polling of what New Zealanders really think. And the samples and the polls that I've seen is that the overwhelming majority of New Zealanders, certainly those in the Ipsum electorate that I represent and which I poll fairly frequently, they are of the view that it is well past time that we liberalize.
David, we've got 4 minutes left and we haven't even touched on the freedom of speech. And you've got a myriad of questions there that are coming through online.
Yeah. No, well, what should we talk about?
Freedom of speech? What the questions are there. There's some important ones there. Well, why don't you fly at that? If not, let's talk about the freedom of speech. There'll be no surprises there because we all know what your thoughts are on freedom of speech.
Yeah. So starting from in the beginning, there was a Law Commission report which recommended that abortion be taken out of the Crimes Act. So the Law Commission did their research, talked to a bunch of people. One of the questions they asked is, should we copy some other countries which have laws which say you cannot protest abortion within an area around an abortion clinic? And the Law Commission thought about this and they talked to people and they got the best advice that they could to try and answer this question. And eventually they gave an answer to the question of whether there should be safe areas around abortion clinics. Mm-hmm. And the answer they gave was no. Then the government comes along and has a go at trying to work out what should the law be. And they drafted a bill that, surprise, surprise, had safe areas in it. And what they're really proposing is that a minister of the crown, an elected politician, can sign a piece of paper, an order in council, and say your right to freedom of expression, despite being guaranteed in the Bill of Rights Act, are struck out in this area. That's when you take all the emotion away.
Yeah.
It's about a politician being able to strike down Bill of Rights at will. And I'm totally opposed to that. So I removed, through amendment in the lawmaking process, it was me who removed those because I think freedom of speech is so important. Now, let me say, you know, I understand that a lot of people are very angry about that, including people who support Act's usual position and my usual position of being pro-women's choice. And they say, how could you possibly defend these awful people who yell and abuse and call women names and make them cry when they're already very vulnerable? Mm. And I understand all that. I do. However, I go back to what the Law Commission said. Existing laws are adequate. You know, I think the existing laws need to be enforced better, but ACT will never support eroding our freedom of speech and saying that, you know, freedom of speech is not really a right. If a minister uses this law, they can just erase it in an area of New Zealand. I think that precedent is terrible. So for better or worse, that's the position we've taken in favour of free speech.
You got the support of Parliament, though, did you? It was a conscious decision, wasn't it, in Parliament? So they didn't have to take the party line.
In this case, I think it was an unconscious decision by some of them.
Well, yeah, I mean, look,
you know, got close to actually getting it through, didn't you?
Well, we did get it through.
Well, I mean, yeah. Through.
You got to be a good tactician in Parliament, and the other side forgot to call for a vote. So, I don't know. I think we probably did have the numbers on the vote, but it never got counted. So, I went through without a vote count.
So, it got through. Mm. Okay, what does that mean? So, those 150 meters, they weren't allowed to protest. So, now they can.
Well, I mean, let's be clear about the laws that still exist and the laws that have always existed. You know, the current law says that under the Summary Offences Act, if you are offensive, I think that goes too far, but if you're offensive, intimidating or threatening to a person in a public space, you could be arrested, you could be fined, you can be told to cease and desist by a police officer. So people can, you know, stand up and, you know, wave placards or, you know, chant things or do whatever crazy stuff they want to do as protesters. The minute that they threaten, intimidate, block someone's path, you know, squirt them with water pistols, do anything like that, they're breaking the law. And I hope the cops go down there and give them hell, because it's just wrong to interfere in someone else's choice that way. That's the law that we have and will continue to have, but we will not have a law that bans all speech in a particular area.
Nice way to finish it there. And we will have to wrap this up a little bit. So, Beth, you want a final word on that? Just a final word.
I guess a lot of people would have wondered, you know, how would I have voted if I had been in Parliament? Mm-hmm. And like the end of life choice bill, I started off with a lot of reservations. But I think on the balance of arguments that I've heard, I would have voted it through these first two readings, and I would have supported David's amendment as well.
Good to hear.
Oh, good. That's great good to know.
So we'd still be talking to you.
Well, Max, there's people on the comments saying Max Whitehead should be an ACT MP, so you never know.
Well,
what would you have said?
I've got to say, I'm very attracted to the ACT policies. I'm very attracted to the principles. And, well, David, I think I'd like to have a conversation with you, Bowen Day, about that.
I tell you what, he's already got the ability of avoiding the question. And maybe
should you have voted on how you voted on the bill?
Should be a
Labour MP. Well, let's talk about it next week. Back next week? What do we got next week? You think lined up at all?
Oh, who knows? I'm not sure. It's such a chaos roller coaster.
We have some wonderful person.
Beth just told us that the next 3 days have been cancelled. All the public meetings have been sort of put on hold.
Well, that's certainly true. A lot of, like, I was scheduled to be in Palmerston North this week. We may still go ahead with our public meeting, but we are not doing the central field days. We're really looking forward to talking to a lot of the rural sector around the central North Island. That's not the lower North Island. That's not happening now.
I hope you can go, because I think they would have liked to talk to you too.
All right, guys, well, we've got to wrap it up here. So I'd like to thank Podcast New Zealand for hosting us. That's them with the little placard over there. If you want to watch us, we're on David Seymour's Facebook page every Monday, same time, 7:30. Give us a look. We're on YouTube. We're on Twitter. Just use David's names and we will find us there. And look, thanks for watching. And I'm looking forward to you guys coming back to watch another one. And will Max Whitehead stand for ACT at the election? My God, that's very tempting.
Tempting for everyone. See you later.
Good night,
thanks,
everyone.
Everybody.
Good night.
Politics in Full Sentences. An intelligent take on the week's politics with a strong lashing of free markets and free minds.